I was on a date a few weeks ago, about a month ago. And, you know, the way that millennials determine their compatibility is by giving their list of everything they think is wrong with the world and why the world is about to end. And this person on this date, you know, kind of gave their list of reasons as to why the apocalypse was right around the corner. And at the very end, this, litany of problems said, and of course, all of this is a result of late capitalism. I said, what do you mean by late capitalism? And he said, well, it's, you know, the contradictions have just become so intense that this can't last longer. I'm thinking, like, do you have any idea that you don't know what you're talking about? It's just so obvious.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Diet Soap is a Sublation Media podcast.
Kyle Bosch is a doctoral candidate in comparative literature at the University of Minnesota and the author of the essay Too Late for Late Capitalism for Compact Magazine. I reached out to him after I read the article. I saw a tweet about it. I'm interested in the idea of late capitalism and was glad to invite you on, Kyle, to discuss your essay and the underlying notions that are in it. So thank you for coming on to the Diet Soap podcast.
Well, thanks for having me here. I'm looking forward to talking about this term with you guys.
Yeah. So your recent essay was entitled Too Late for Late Capitalism. And in it, you puncture Ann Cornblith's book, Immediacy, or the Style of Too Late Capitalism, in this way. This is what you write about her book. You say, her book will be less informative to readers searching for a sociological diagnosis of this predicament than to readers interested in observing how this superficiality unfolds in the realm of theory. And the predicament we're in is living in a superficial world, and you are saying she is a symptom of what she's trying to diagnose. I just want to say, as a publisher of critical theory, I'm all too familiar with this way of writing about critical theory, filled with buzzwords that indicate very little. But I also want to discuss this idea of late capitalism, which you argue is a notion or a term which is out of date. So I'm hoping to learn about Werner Sombart, a figure I don't know as much about or anything about, really. How did Sombart arrive at the notion of late capitalism?
Well, he arrived at it just insofar as this early middle, or rather early high late schema is very common in the 19th century and early 20th century German historiographic tradition. So it's very common to speak of late Gothic or high Gothic architecture or late antiquity, late Renaissance. These kinds of things are just how Germans tend to periodize movements or systems. So in that sense, it's not such an unusual term, even though he was probably the first to use it. It became very popular very fast, and everyone sort of intuitively knew what he meant because German readers were used to thinking of systems evolving in this way from their high to their late phase. I can say a little bit more about him, though, and his work. He first coined this term, or he first presented this typology of early high late capitalism in a 1902 work called, it's the first volume of a three-volume work called Modern Capitalism. The first volume was in 1902. The third volume was in 1927, which is where he kind of most presents what late capitalism looks like. But this idea that capitalism goes through these three stages is there from the very beginning. And these are massive 1,000-page works of history, very much inspired by Marx at this point in his life. Anyway, he becomes a critic of Marxism later on in his life. But at the very beginning, he's sort of seen as the Marxist economist in Germany at the time. He's probably the most distinguished sociologist or economic sociologist alongside Max Weber. The two of them are colleagues. The two of them found a journal together, the Archive for Social Science and Social Policy. They're the two main editors when this is founded in 1904, 1905. So he belongs to that milieu, and it surprises me actually that he's not really very much discussed today in a way that obviously someone like Max Weber is. There are different calibers, and Max Weber is so much more methodologically interesting and interesting as a person than Zombart is, but he's a major game player in German economic sociology of those first couple of decades, and very much inspired by this romantic 19th century tradition of German historiography, the one that sees historical and social systems as organisms. This kind of organological vision of society is at the back of Zombart's topology, and this image of late capitalism is so much an image of a society that's becoming old, becoming mature, and entering into its stage of senility, but also of rationality, kind of mastering all the problems that it had in its adulthood.
Okay. So if you were to compare early, what was it? Early, high, and late Gothic architecture to these designations, early, high, and late capitalism, how would they compare? I mean, would late Gothic architecture be a period of decadence and decline, or would it be thought of as a moment where Gothic architecture was about to be transformed into what came next and then kind of sublated, to use the name of the media company I work for, into something else? How are these terms used in other contexts?
In the simplest sense, the high phase, the middle phase, is the ideal typical phase. So high capitalism is just synonymous. Capitalism is in its kind of pure form, so to speak. And the early phase is the phase that still has elements of a previous system involved in it, intermingled with it. And the late phase is the one in which we're sort of transitioning into something different, and we're losing these ideal archetypal features of the high phase. In art historical terms, it could probably mean a couple of different things. One of them being that high or late Renaissance painting, which would be mannerism, is moving away from Renaissance style into the Baroque. It's a sort of transitionary phase. Or you could think of it as kind of more rigid, formulaic, mannered, artificial sort of rationalization of techniques that were emerging and coming into their own during the High Renaissance period. I think this latter characterization is more what Zombart has in mind, that late capitalism is really this harnessing all of these different conflicts that you see in the high phase of capitalism and making it more rational and stable and rigid, so to speak. It's this kind of rigidification or brutalization of what's happening during the high phase. I'm not sure how well this art historical vocabulary maps onto what Zombart is doing, in part because Zombart, in addition to this kind of cyclical theory of culture, or this theory of cultural systems that just sort of arise and die, which is very much a part of this 19th century tradition, Zombart is combining this with this Hegelian Marxist universal historical, you know, linear Judeo-Christian eschatological vision of history that does continually sublate itself into higher and higher forms. And so the transition from capitalism to socialism, or from late capitalism into early socialism, which are these are kind of synonyms for him, is a sublation in the sense that you're using this term. It's a movement into a higher phase and not just simply a different phase. So the cyclical theory of culture the theory of cultural systems that arise and die is combined with this universal linear architectonic in Zombarton. A number of interesting ways that are sort of methodologically problematic, but also very common for his time, I think, to have these two visions of history operating simultaneously.
Yes. So I first heard about late capitalism Oh, I don't know. When I was young in the '90s, Jameson was a big figure around that time. And it seemed like a cool thing to talk about, you know, late capitalism seemed, but it had this connotation like, that we were in late capitalism, which meant things were truly bad. Like right. Things are really, really awful in late capitalism. But in reality, you argue in your essay, the idea of it being rigid or systematized kind of maps onto one aspect of the state capitalist idea. The late capitalist idea. Because late capitalism was the period where the administrative state rose up, where rather than a bunch of private capitalist entrepreneurs running the world, things were managed. Today people talk about the PMC as a new class, and that's been kicked around since the 50s. I think Burnham wrote about that. So and it was also associated with the Fordist welfare state, the late capitalist phase. So I'm going to ask it this way. When you read Anne Kornbluth's book, did she hold on to that Fordist model for late capitalism? And also, I guess, did Sombart have that kind of idea as well, that it was the way the state was managing capitalist relations that defined it as late?
Yeah, well, that's precisely right about what Sombart thinks, that late capitalism is managed capitalism or a planned economy or whatever other kind of synonym you wanted to use for this. I'm sure all these terms are different to specialists, but I see them all kind of in the same early 20th century, mid-century imaginary of capitalism becoming managed in that sense. Fordism, the synonym for late capitalism by Ernest Mandel and by that whole tradition as well, that's, you know, writing in the time in which Fordism was a popular term. So what's interesting to me is that from 1902, when the term was first coined, up until the late 70s, maybe 1980, there's a utterly coherent, consistent use of this term, late capitalism. It means the same thing to everyone. You could have a conversation about what late capitalism is, but know what you're talking about. And Jameson threw this curveball into this conceptual history in 1984 when he just uses the term in such a vague manner. His essay on the cultural logic of late capitalism has very little to say about what late capitalism is and how the economy of late capitalism is structured. It's a couple of sentences saying, I read this great book by Ernest Mandel called Late Capitalism. It sounds so wonderful. Let's just kind of rely on this term. He's a sort of, you know, a popularizer of terms. That's what Jameson does. I'm too much, but that's... since Jameson's essay, it seems to me... Well, it seems to me, first of all, that I don't know how popular the term was in the 90s and the 2000s. It sort of exploded in popularity over the past 10 or 15 years. I have a hypothesis that maybe Jonathan Crary's book on 24/7 or late capitalism and the ends of sleep was a moment in which the term became revitalized. That's when I was in college or my master's program and people started using this term again and I started noticing it. Today, it's almost always a synonym for neoliberalism, which, you know, in our common periodizations is the phase that comes after late capitalism, or at least the phase that comes after this managed administrative state capitalism. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit puzzling. It's extremely puzzling that this one term, late capitalism, could so easily be adapted to two different phases that we generally accept as being antithetical to each other, or the two different phases that define the past 100 years.
Yeah. Well, the explanation I think I sent you with my sample questions was to suggest that because neoliberalism was a sublation of welfare Fordist administrative capitalism, only rather than aiming at redistributing the wealth amongst the consumer class or the working class, and creating social safety nets and welfare programs, neoliberalism turn around and try to secure financial stability for big capital. And so it was a redistribution of wealth amongst the capitalist class rather than for the working class. But it was still an administrative state. It still was an integrated kind of state capitalist formation. I can't remember which of the neoliberal economists who kind of were early pioneers of that term and advocated for it got upset and called his colleagues socialists and stormed out of the room. But I mean, there was
one called someone a socialist for having the slightest positive feelings toward state administration. That's right, because he's the sort of most dogmatic.
Right. So, if you take that to be what neoliberalism is, which is the state, the control of the economy by the state in the service of capital and profitability, does that clear away some of the difficulty with the term making the jump from the Fordist period and past the 70s into the 80s and 90s?
I mean, what you're asking that is the term still applicable if we neoliberal?
Yeah, I mean, is it enough to say that it's the state, the planned aspect of the economy that makes it late, or is there something else about late capitalism beyond the role that the state takes and the level of planning and administration that is being taken up?
If it's just simply a matter of administration, state administration of the economy, then maybe there's some application to the term. I mean, the thing is, the term is almost exclusively used by cultural theorists, by people like Jameson and people that are inspired by Jameson.
Mm-hmm.
It's also most often used specifically to demarcate something that comes after this kind of mid-century high modernist moment that it's very obviously identifiable with what the British war Jameson called late capitalism. So if we're using late capitalism as a term to distinguish what's happening, let's say after the economic crisis of the 1970s from what happened before, it doesn't work well to distinguish these two things, because as what you're saying is it's sort of a creative bridge between these things. In that sense, the term I think it's probably totally fine to think that we still live in a phase that's a sublation of mid-century state capitalism or a continuation of it mutation of it in some form. But as far as we're interested in making a distinction between what happened before the 70s and what happened afterward, it doesn't make sense to use the term late capitalism to describe what happened after when it was traditionally used to describe the whole structure of what came before. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's talk about the cultural side of it a bit, because so late capitalism was associated with high modernist forms of life and aesthetics and culture, right? So modernist architecture, often emphasizing the functional aspects of a building rather than the decorative or the facade. I read about this in the past, and the names aren't coming to me for the architects, but brutalist architecture might be a form of high modernism. Around 1972, there was a book called Learning from Las Vegas.
Venturi.
Yeah. That was sort of a manifesto for breaking with high modernism and allowing for kind of kit forms that were more directly coming out of the masses to take hold of the architectural world and to be celebrated. So like a coffee shop that's actually literally in the shape of a donut would be the kind of thing that you might celebrate after you've learned from Las Vegas. So that might be just a way to imagine the difference between what's normally thought of as late capitalism, which is functional architecture in a planned economy, and the neoliberal form, which is driven by marketing and imagery and a mass culture. Do you think that's a good way to make that distinction in cultural terms?
Yeah, that's probably one aspect. I mean, for Jameson, so Jameson was inspired by Las Vegas book presentation of postmodern architecture. And it's really about this loss of historicity where the past becomes, you know, just a trove of these different signifiers and images that you could sort of playfully reappropriate. I mean, I think of, you know, the Las Vegas architecture is obviously the greatest example of this, but, you know, like the Paris Hotel as being this sort of a pastiche of what Paris actually looks like. The hotel is, you know, 8 times as big as a normal Parisian building, but it has all these kind of architectural features that remind you of Paris, and it's a replica of the Eiffel Tower and everything. So that's what Jameson sort of has in mind with this loss of historicity, that past styles can just be sort of cited in this way, and they're significant in that way. Another big distinction, I think, an aesthetic distinction between late capitalist or, you know, mid-century and late 20th century or postmodern aesthetics is there's this primacy of plan. If there's a primacy of planning in the late capitalist or mid-century, I never know what to call late capitalist because we're using it in both senses, but if the primacy of planning in this kind of mid-century state capitalist formation, then that sort of corresponds to the primacy of the blueprint in mid-century architecture. So things are, you know, I mean, I think you called it functional, but there's this kind of tendency to design things in accordance with a design, something that has a kind of a geometric structure or regularity or logical sense to it, in a way that postmodern architecture sort of has a kind of haphazard quality to it. I mean, so if planning is sort of the basic feature of mid-century state capitalism, and then if we follow the neoliberals like Hayek and think that the basis of a neoliberal society or a postmodern society, if that's these two terms are equivalent, would be a spontaneous order, and there's this kind of organic, haphazard aesthetic dimension to postmodern or to late 20th century architecture, where, and that this is what Jameson identifies in the Bonaventura Hotel, is that it just seems sort of illogical. It couldn't possibly come from a blueprint because it's just oddly organized. There's entrances in different bizarre areas of the building, and it just doesn't really seem like it's organized according to a logical plan. It's this planlessness of architecture and aesthetics generally that I think makes something postmodern in Jameson's sense and neoliberal.
Well, you almost have to become a conspiracy theorist to think that the Bonaventura Hotel had a plan, because it's so disorienting.
Right.
If it did have a plan, then the plan was to disorient the occupants and the passersby around the Bonaventura Hotel. But I think Jameson actually believes that is the case as well. That the forms of authority that would be plainly visible and transparent in a modernist building are made invisible and disorienting in the Bonaventura Hotel, and that for being invisible, they're all the more domineering and absolute. I think they it's kind of tricky, because, you know, we're talking about efficient, well-crafted buildings that have their own aesthetic quality, but emphasize being useful for their human occupants, you know, like these perfect residences for the modern subject who is leading a good life in an urban setting, right? So everything's where it should be, it's thought through, it's transparent, and it fits the person that's living there in its details, right? And it assists them in their life. Whereas postmodern buildings, you know, and postmodern residences are about communicating a sensibility, one that's, but also a sensibility that's usually kitsch or prefabricated or ready-made, that that will have some sort of emotional effect maybe on the occupant or the passerby, but that in no way is truly efficient in helping them realize their own potential as citizens in society, but rather simply appeals to their desires in some way or another, and maybe on a very crass level, like that, you know, donut-shaped building. When you talk about the loss of historicity, and that's what Jameson talks about, I think of also maybe the loss of the notion that a human being could direct their own lives, and that the built environment around them is about developing forms of freedom for them. Whereas what's free in a postmodern life is the flow of commodities and desires, and people are more like animals. Is that, am I acting like a typical Verso critical theorist? Like, you know, should I write the book Immediacy? But you tell me.
What bothers me about Jameson's essay, and in particular the several paragraphs devoted to the Bonaventura Hotel, is that there's no clear economic explanation as to why the hotel is organized this way. He argues by analogy a lot of the time. He says that I think it's the final paragraph of this section on the hotel, where he says that the experience of walking through this hotel is kind of like the experience of being in a globalized capitalistic society. The hotel is so large and disorienting that you can't really find your way. And if you want to go to this one shop a second time, you might not be able to find it because it's, you know, the building is organized in this bizarre manner. And it's sort of like that, living in a globalist capitalistic society in which everything is so large and disorienting that we can't really see where we find ourselves in this massive sublime space. That's not an argument as to why the hotel was designed this way. It's kind of impressionistic. And you see this in like Eric Zimmel's writing, the philosophical and sociological impressionist or something like that. Jameson is impressionistic in the same sense that he identifies aspects of what he thinks the economy looked like in the mid-1980s or early 1990s. He identifies certain kinds of features of what it feels like to walk through a building and says, here's my economic explanation of what culture means today. That's how Anna Kornblau operates in a lot of ways as well. And this is how the Verso sort of a kind of, you know, critic of capitalism or cultural critic of capitalism operates as well.
Well, let me give you the reflexive answer I have for that, for my kind of half-baked learning around the left, right? I would say, okay, after the Paris Commune, you had the Haussmannization of Paris, the Parisian streets were widened in order to allow the state to have easier access into the city, and to ensure that no bottom-up movements like the Commune could arise again. So you had a rational plan for Paris. Things were more grid-like and efficient in response to the threat that was perceived to be there from the people of Paris. And so, like, if you imagine that in the 60s around the world, that the New Left and the revolutionary movements at that time that culminated in 1968 were thought of as being a threat to the established order, creating a built environment which would, on the one hand, take up some of the demands of 68, like, you know, live out your desires, there's no more dead time, that kind of thing. And at the same time, make sure that communication and self-direction and is more difficult. That could arise, maybe not in a directly planned, like, we want to make sure people are confused conspiracy, but more as an ideological reaction to the threat from an organized left. I think that's overstating the case for the 68 revolutionary movements and for the real threat from the new left. And it doesn't take into account how a lot of those people who came out of that actually instigated and helped postmodernism along, people like Deleuze and others. But nonetheless, that's what I would offer up as an explanation.
So what are you saying is the
explanation, right? Okay, yeah, right. I'm being a critical theory kind of guy. I'm not being clear. I think that the explanation would be that the Bonaventure Hotel creates disorientation in order to protect the form of life, in order to hold on to capitalist relations and to suppress politics and when defined as the attempt by civil society to take up and control all of society, rather than the management of politics by this administrative state and the capitalist class in collaboration.
And so that would be an explanation for why the Bonaventura Hotel was designed in this way,
it wouldn't be an economic explanation. It would be a political one, right? So the economics would inform it, but you're talking about, I don't know what went into the construction of the Bonaventure Hotel, but I imagine that the state was involved, that it was not simply some entrepreneur making an investment hoping for a profit, but rather that a lot of bureaucratic planning and forms and permitting had to be brought together, that they selected an architect based on their prestige and their being au courant and aligned with the most advanced architectural ideologies, and that all of those things combined produce a disorientation which actually did service the political needs of the capitalist state.
I think there's some plausibility to that. I mean, it's hard to make these arguments in the particular hotel, but on a larger scale, to talk about architectural or aesthetic trends. Serviceable. I haven't read this book in so long, but it was very influential to me when I first encountered it. The New Spirit of Capitalism by...
You cut out for a second. The New Spirit of Capitalism by whom?
Luc Poltanski and Yves Chapello.
No, I haven't read that one.
The late 90s, and it was translated sometime, maybe 10 years after that, into English. And it examines the management literature in France in the 1980s to look at how corporations were restructuring themselves in such a way as to give individuals a greater sense of autonomy and flexibility and, a kind of dehierarchized corporate structure that reflects these demands of the culture of 1968 to live a kind of more autonomous life that they were kind of arguing for in a moment when they were suffocating under this kind of administrative centralized grip of late capitalism. The point of the book, it's one of these 600-page sociological books, very extremely dense, but their main argument is that neoliberalism was so successful because it responded to these kinds of what they call the artistic critique of 1968, this desire for autonomy and flexibility and freedom. Corporations realized, we can actually restructure ourselves in such a way as to fulfill these desires for these individuals that be more happily integrated into society and not rise up and protest so much. I mean, it wasn't really like corporations cynically had this idea, but it just sort of flexibly or organically worked out in this manner.
Yeah. The cubicle is kind of a response to those demands. So you have a less hierarchical floor plan. Everyone has their unit rather than there being a structured of offices. And each time you get a promotion, you get a bigger room, in the cubicle world. Or when I was really a young kid, I went to a progressive school. It was public school, but it was in a nice part of town. And they had removed all the walls between the classrooms.
Right.
In order to have an open floor an open plan for educating the young across grade levels. And then they had to put up basically what amounted to cubicle walls in order to actually teach at all. So, yeah, I know. I think that's right. I think we can see how the political demands that are made in response to difficulties, like the feeling of oppression that came from the rising bureaucracy that defined the welfare state period, we can see how those political demands are taken up and somewhat met in order to continue with essentially the same political economic system. So I don't think you're wrong there, but I have some more written down, some more questions written down, and I kind of want to come back to late capitalism, because on the one hand, I've sort of tried to argue or make a soft case for late capitalism being applicable across these two terrains, because capitalism is there in both cases, and even estate capitalism is there in both periods. But there's another aspect to it which we should talk about, which is the optimistic dimension of talking about late capitalism, which I think Jameson jettisons in a way when it gets into the postmodern period. Like, the optimistic idea of late capitalism is that it is, capitalism is ending and there's something new arising, that the, if it's late, then that means that it, that we can start to see the glimmer of a new kind of society. And if you're nicely orthodox Marxist, you assume that what comes after capitalism is something better rather than regression into something worse. But do you think Jameson, am I right in that Jameson kind of eliminated that optimistic aspect of the term late capitalism?
I'm not quite sure. I don't even know that it necessarily has this. It definitely has this optimistic dimension today, when it's,
you think so?
Sort of, you know, it's, I mean, late capitalism today is like a youth cultural criticism slang, sort of. It appears among people on social media very frequently, as a kind of condensation of apocalyptic feelings and optimism at one and the same time. We're at the end of something that just seems so catastrophically terrible, but it's the end because something else has to come afterward because it's late. And Adorno, that he's really the popularizer of this term, but he did use it in a couple of significant contexts. It refers to a system that could go on indefinitely. He sort of saw this horror in late capitalism and the fact that it's sort of the last chapter that could theoretically never end, because it eliminates all of, doesn't eliminate, well, Pollock's idea is that you could have a crisis-free capitalism, this is the state capitalism thesis, that could last theoretically indefinitely, because no longer is our economic contradictions a motor of historical dynamism, but really there's this kind of primacy of politics. And this sort of gets translated into Adorno's idea of what late capitalism is as well. I don't think when Adorno uses the term late capitalism, there's this anticipation that socialism is on the way or some other kind of social formation. And in Zombart, since late capitalism and early socialism are one and the same thing, you don't really run into these problems. He doesn't really see late capitalism as being this kind of constellation of terror that it was for the tradition after him, with Frankfurter schoolers and in exile and it was, well. Where are we going with this?
No, I just was wondering if you saw optimism in the term now, the way I thought it was present in the, from your description of Zombart, not from my own reading or anything, because if you think of late capitalism as the beginning of a planned economy and you're kind of a Marxist in the early 20th century or late 19th century, then you're going to think, well, you know, capitalism is evolving into socialism. You know, a planned economy and a kind of rational distribution of goods and everyone chipping in and working together, and both centralized production and more freedom locally, all of this together will be socialism.
basically is, right. was the idea, I think. And so, but now there's like an optimism, but it's this sort of terrible optimism. It's optimism of like, oh, things will finally fall apart so something new can be born. Is that?
Yeah, it's a completely different image than what Zumbaud had. I mean, I guess we can call Zumbaud optimistic in the sense that he thought that history had a natural fatal course that it had to run through. And he was relieved by the fact the movement from high capitalism to late capitalism appeared to be happening. You know, he's prophesying it sort of in the early 20th century. And then during the 1920s and then especially in the 1930s, he says, we've arrived. Wonderful. You know, he saw National Socialism as being an example of late capitalism or early socialism. So he's not a revolutionary thinker. I think he says this in the introduction to the 1902 version of Modern Capitalism. He says, you know, I'm trying to replace Marx's revolutionary view with a kind of organic evolutionary view. And today, insofar as the term late capitalism has some optimism attached to it, it's because we've returned to this revolutionary view, the idea that things are going to get just so bad, the contradictions are going to be so, you know, intensified that the whole system is just going to explode and we're going to finally have the freedom to reorganize life in a new way. So Zumbaud's optimism is very justified. He's noticing an increased centralization of the economy, and that's what he wanted. That's what he thought socialism would look like. That's
right. Let me ask you completely a question I didn't write down. When you took up the task of reading Ann Kornbluth's book, how did that happen? What made you decide to read immediacy?
I was on a date a few weeks ago, about a month ago. And, you know, the way that millennials determine their compatibility is by giving their list of everything they think is wrong with the world and why the world is about to end.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please do consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons help to make sure that Sublation Media can continue to provide interviews, videos, books, and articles that are critical of the left from the left. If you are tired of remaining stuck within bourgeois ideologies and politics, help us sublate them both.